This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Diversify is an annual business summit here in Chattanooga that highlights diversity, inclusion, and today's workplace. The pandemic and last year's unrest have underscored the high cost of racial and economic inequality for a business community that aims to be for everyone. This year's Diversify, which will be virtual, takes place on Friday, presented by the Chattanooga Area Chamber of Commerce and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. Lauren Steedley is the Chamber's Vice President for Diversity and Economic Growth. I spoke with him last week. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And welcome to Chattanooga and the Chattanooga Area Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you again very much. I appreciate it.
We are here to talk about Diversify. This is an event that has been offered by the Chamber the past few years. This year, given the past year between the pandemic and unrest and all these questions about diversity and equity and inclusion coming back to the fore again, this is quite a time to be holding the event this year.
Absolutely. A lot going on in the United States and around the world, and circumstances regarding the pandemic have been impactful. Issues that have come up as a byproduct of some of the things that are going on. But at the same time, it creates a special opportunity with regards to economic inclusion, business expansion, and much of the work in which my focus is how to look at this as an opportunity to really grow and expand the local economy and be more inclusive as we look at economic opportunity.
What are some of the things that have popped up on your radar so far from your vantage point coming into Chattanooga?
Well, I think there, what I see is tremendous opportunity. And I factor that into not only the scenic beauty of the city, but also the geography of the city in relation to other markets at the same time. Also, always looking at this from a global perspective. So understanding that from the point of view of market growth, market expansion, innovation, entrepreneurship, you can do it all here, right here in Chattanooga. And one of the biggest things is trying to create a space and opportunity where folks see this as a destination of opportunity. And I think in these times, I think at this timing for the chamber, the city to really show itself or demonstrate in that way that this is a place where folks can succeed economically and also through business expansion.
And the keynote speaker gets to the heart of this from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Absolutely. Rick Wade, he's been in this space for a tremendous amount of time. He's worked with the U.S. Chamber for a number of years now, also prior, worked with the Commerce Department for the U.S. government. So his insight around an initiative titled Economic Opportunity Initiative really cast a broad light on looking at issues of opportunity gaps with regards to education, employment, entrepreneurship, and even think a little more closely, more critically around criminal justice as well.
And we hear about this all the time in Chattanooga. The students who come to an institution such as UTC, and they don't stay, including and especially from the most underserved populations, the most underserved communities in Chattanooga, but also from elsewhere.
Yes, I think one of the things, and this is yet another opportunity, and I've talked to business leaders here in the city, and they very much have this on their radar, and they're doing, taking some extraordinary efforts to try to look at talent from the point of view of the value add of talent diversity, looking at retention, and looking at being very creative in ways to further garner support for students who are here in the city as a way of a possible destination as they launch their careers. And I think collectively, there's a number of partners, the chamber being a part of that, and how we bring and sort of elevate the city itself as an opportunity, as a place of opportunity. So I think going forward, the objective is to work a little bit more closely with institutions like UTC in a way to really solidify the understanding that this is a place where people can come, young people can come, not only go to school, but stay and really flourish in their careers.
What from your experience in Atlanta is echoed by your time here so far in Chattanooga? Where are you seeing things that are the same? Where are you seeing things that are different when it comes to the type of work that you do, when it comes to a type of event such as the Diversify Summit?
And if I can unpack that question, I think it's different parts to it. I think on one level, you know, Atlanta, in terms of the comparisons, you really don't. We're focused right now on Chattanooga. I think it's about the scenic beauty of the city. Again, I see just being at a space and a place where you can be a part of something really extraordinary in the economic development space. You can be really extraordinary in creating synergy and gravity around Chattanooga. So those are the things I'm most excited about. And those are the areas where I focus my efforts. And I see a lot of the, in terms of locally, as I mentioned, this moved into the city this week, but I haven't had a chance to ride around a little bit. A lot of great opportunities like downtown. I've had a chance to get near the river, near the Tennessee River, just to do a little sightseeing. I mean, just the way the topography is laid out in the city, it's a beautiful place. And I think that can be very appealing if you throw in the fact that the state of Tennessee is tax-free. So I think that those as a combination makes this an extraordinary time. And I'm just excited because I feel like I'm on the ground floor in a time that something's really going to be exciting in terms of growth and development here in the city and in the region.
And after Rick Wade's keynote, there will be a panel discussion led by Dion Jenkins of Tennessee Valley Federal Credit Union.
Yeah, well, I was going a little bit deeper on the speaker because I've probably known him since we were an undergraduate, so it helps. One of the things I will share is that, again, he's been very committed, long extended history and work into this space. I've seen him do some extraordinary things right now. They're doing this work around the Equality of Opportunity Initiative. Much of that, again, is trying to elevate everything from looking at procurement. How do you look at procurement as a pipeline and an opportunity and a pathway to building business and inclusion and entrepreneurship? I think the other part is, again, having talked to some of the locally here, just how this work pings off of efforts, not only in, like I said, procurement, but supply chain. This is some work that we've elevated at the chamber through one of our DEI sessions. And then looking at from the point of view of how we can look at inclusion as an economic opportunity. And that I need to be clear about this, Ray. My work around everything from the CEO pledge to what we're doing with Diversified, DEI Forum, et cetera, is all about how do you look at diversity, how do you look at racial equity as an economic benefit, as an economic driver to grow and expand business. So that's the focus of it. And so Rick, I think his message to us on Friday is going to carry that forward. And I think secondly, Dion is going to be our facilitator, and she's going to lead in this conversation, looking not only from a point of view from hospitality, because we have some O'Malley coming in from hospitality, and then also we have Justin from our chamber. He's going to talk about the policy implications and what that really means in terms of expanding opportunity, being more inclusive. And in no way, when I say expanding and inclusive, it doesn't exclude anyone. It's really about how do you bring more people to the table. At the end of the day, you're expanding the economy. Therefore, the tax revenues that you can generate, you're looking at everything. I think Morgan Stanley did a report and they looked at it a little bit more critically and said, just in housing and banking, you're looking at 800,000 jobs unrealized. I think it was Citigroup that did a report last year that talked about for the last decade, discrimination cost the U.S. economy like $16 trillion. So these are real numbers and very impactful dollars. And we're hopeful that Diversify starts us along that path in terms of information, how to go about solving the more complicated problems of inclusion and looking at it through this window of economic expansion, business development, that's at the end of the day, is going to be great for the city of Chattanooga and it'll be great for Hamilton County.
And when you talk about these components, whether the supply chain or the jobs pipeline, what we're finding here, what we're remembering here is all of these pieces have to fit together. And if you're missing a few pieces or one piece, or you have the right pieces, but they are not aligned the way that they need to be, then you don't complete the puzzle.
Absolutely. Absolutely in agreement. And I mean, it's a large part of this position is really trying to align partnerships. Also looking at how do you build coalitions that are in its core about economic inclusion and expansion. I know I'm sounding repetitive, continue to say that, but at its core, that's what it's about. So again, at these earlier stages, reaching out to members of the business community, reaching out to members of UTC, reaching out to the other nonprofit members of communities here, and then thinking higher ed, the medical community, because we understand that everything is sort of interconnected. As I mentioned, been on a number of calls where local leaders here and managing leaders, as well as, of course, the CEOs here, have talked very passionately about their emphasis and importance of talent. They've spoke very passionately about the importance and significance of talent diversity. So I think in some ways it's trying to develop or contribute to a shared vision and then trying to carry that vision forward.
And where can people go online for more information about the Diversify Summit and participate?
Diversify, you can go to our website, ChattanoogaChamber.com. And if you go and click on Diversify, you'll have a drop down and it'll give you information on registering. Also give you a little bit more background on the keynote speaker as well as the panelists who are going to take part as well.
All right, Lauren, thanks so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Ray. Look forward to meeting you real soon in person.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called him the greatest preacher to ever live.
What you're really trying to do is intimidate these people, and by making them stand in the rain, keep them from registering to vote. And this is a kind of violation of the Constitution, the violation of the court order, the violation of decent citizenship. You can turn your back on me, but you cannot turn your back upon the idea of justice.
The Reverend C.T. Vivian was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement alongside Dr. King and others in the 1950s and 60s. When Reverend Vivian tried to register black voters in Selma, Alabama in 1965, Sheriff Jim Clark punched him, a scene caught on camera and broadcast on television nationwide. Reverend Vivian died last year at the age of 95. Steve Pfeiffer is the co-author of his posthumous memoir, It's in the Action, Memories of a Nonviolent Warrior, published by New South Books in Montgomery.
Steve, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Tell us more about how you came to know C.T. Vivian.
Well, in 2014, I was writing a different civil rights-related book called Jimmy Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America. About two foot soldiers of the movement were participating in the voting rights effort in the Selma area in 1965. Jimmy Lee Jackson, a black farmer from down there, and Reverend James Reeb, a white Unitarian minister from the north, each of whom lost their lives, one as a state trooper and one at the hands of a group of white supremacist thugs. And Dr. Vivian, as you know, was very involved in the movement in Selma at that time, leading voting rights efforts. And indeed, he had spoken to the assembled at the church that Jimmy Lee Jackson had been at right before he was shot by the state trooper. So I wanted to talk to Dr. Vivian about the events in Selma that had led to the Voting Rights Act. And we struck up a conversation on the phone, me in Illinois and him in Georgia. We really hit it off. And when I discovered that this incredibly important figure in the civil rights movement had never written the story of his life, a memoir, I said, you've got to do it. It took a few years before we actually started doing it, but then we began.
And some of that memoir drew from conversations that he had with his daughter, who also encouraged this work.
Right. Denise Morse, who's just wonderful, had served as the liaison between me and Dr. Vivian, particularly in the later years when his memory was failing. You know, when he passed away last year, he was 95 years old. So his memory of certain events wasn't as great as it had been earlier. So the family was very helpful in getting me documents and other material that helped me put this together when I couldn't fill in the gaps just from conversations with him.
And he was born in Missouri. He grew up across the state line in Illinois, where you were speaking to us from.
Right. His family moved from Boonville, Missouri to Macomb, Illinois when he was five because there was a fire in their home. And they were very deliberate in picking Macomb and going a little further north because both his grandmother and his mother, with whom he lived, were very education oriented. And Macomb was a university town. Western Illinois University was there. The school system, the elementary school system, was integrated, although it was largely white. And they felt that was the best place for young CT to get an education. And he was always very proud of his roots in Western Illinois, although he was quick to point out that he'd suffered both personal and institutional racism there, he still felt very warm ties to that region.
What brought him to the South?
Well, he first moved to Peoria, Illinois, after a few years at Western Illinois University. And he became involved in the movement in 1947 with sit-ins in Peoria to integrate the lunch counters and restaurants. And that actually was his real first taste of nonviolent direct action. And after that, he waited until he had his calling to go to seminary. Everybody had always assumed that he was going to be a preacher. As you know, Dr. King called him the greatest preacher that ever lived. But he said he wasn't going to go to seminary until God actually spoke to him. And that happened in the early 50s when he was working in Peoria. And so he ended up at American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville, who else was there at that time? John Lewis, Bernard Lafayette, Diane Nash, and they all learned nonviolent direct action techniques at the hand of the real master of that system, Jim Lawson, who had actually studied in India. So that took him to Nashville. And then, as you also know, I'm sure, from Nashville, it was on to Chattanooga. And then from there, points everywhere in the South, Birmingham, St. Augustine, and Selma.
And he worked with, was inspired by, and inspired so many people around him in the movement on all of these places on the map and countless more.
Exactly. He was considerably older than most of the other people that were in the movement at that time. When he went to American Baptist for seminary, he was 10, 15 years older than the Nashes and the Lewises and the Lafayettes because, as I said, he had waited for his calling. So he was somewhat of a father figure to them. And while he was in school, he had a church. But he was also, in many ways, although he didn't seek the spotlight, he was the intellectual kind of working behind the scenes in the movement, and they relied on him a great deal for his counsel, as you suggest.
What would you say was his unique contribution beyond serving as a counsel and the intellectual behind the scenes? Something that most people might not know, but if you mention it, if they know anything about the civil rights movement during the 1960s, they can connect the dots.
Let's start with a particularly iconic and critical moment in which he was involved. That took place on February 15th, 1965, when he was leading a group of residents in Selma to try and register at the courthouse. And he had a confrontation with Sheriff Jim Clark, and Clark pushed him down the stairs. And Vivian got up and went right back into confronting Sheriff Clark. That happened to be captured by the national news that happened to be there. And as I've kind of noted, one of the interesting things is that the civil rights movement, when certain events were captured on national TV in those days, when we only had three networks in the 1960s, those were the equivalent of the handheld iPhones of today. And so it just so happened that there was a film crew when Clark and Vivian had their confrontation, and that was broadcast to the North. And Andrew Young has said, if there hadn't been that confrontation, there might not have been a Voting Rights Act, because that confrontation really touched the heart and soul of people in the North and led to kind of further lobbying for civil rights. What I think Dr. Vivian's legacy is, the book is titled, it's in the action. And he sent out a clarion call for not just talking and not just preaching about the need for change, but for actually getting out and doing something. And that, I think, was what he conveyed through his words on the pulpit and also behind the scenes with all the leaders of the movement. And then the idea that you never back down, you never turn away. We have some wonderful quotes from him in the book about not ever giving in to the forces of evil, but continuing to confront them. So I think that's the lasting legacy that we can thank him for.
Tell us more about his life beyond the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Where does his story go from there?
I'm really glad you asked that, because he was a visionary. So after Selma, he recognized that there were a lot of college students who had dropped out of school to be involved in the movement. There were a lot of young people in the South and in the North who needed better educational opportunities. So he created an organization called Vision, which morphed into what is today Upward Bound. So that's one of the efforts he made after the big efforts in the South. Another thing he did was come up north to Chicago, near where I am, because he realized that the next battleground for civil rights was going to be in the North after the South. And here he trained ministers who would be in urban areas to work for civil rights. And he also worked with civic organizations, corporations, the city, and even the gangs of Chicago to get better job opportunities for African Americans. And then he created what was really one of the very first remote learning setups when he set up a remote learning for seminarians who wanted to get their degrees but couldn't attend the school at Shaw University in the Carolinas. And then in the late 70s, again, ahead of his time in recognizing that white supremacy really constituted a real danger to the African-American community, he set up the Anti-Klan Network, which became the Center for Democratic Renewal. And then he moved on to Atlanta, where he got involved in supporting Black businesses and created what really is the first and foremost diversity and inclusion company that still exists. His son Al runs it, and led workshops for corporations, not-for-profits, and governmental agencies into his 90s. So this was a guy who never stopped moving. It was always in the action. And that's really why he had never worked on a memoir before then. That, his busyness, and his humility.
And this memoir, it's 224 pages. So it's a distillation of his experiences and his lessons, those that he learned and those that he wished to impart to those who would come after him.
Right. It's the story of the civil rights movement of the 20th century, I would argue, because he started so early in 1947. So we touch on all of those stops and what actually happened and his philosophy. And then among those 224 pages is just a wonderful photo section that the family helped put together with photos dating back all the way to his early childhood, late 1920s. And they're just some really remarkable photos of the family. And then with him, with all the other movement leaders, and his mugshot from the Freedom Rides and his receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama in 2013. Really quite the man.
What was he like as a person?
He was gentle. He was vivacious. He was humble. He was a man who always wanted to convey his love of words and literature. A lot of people don't know that he was one of the foremost collectors of African-American literature in the country. He amassed some 6,000 volumes of books by African-Americans dating all the way back to colonial times. The family has donated those books to the city of Atlanta, which is going to have the C.T. Vivian and Octavia Vivian Library in a civil rights park there. And I should add one other thing. He was very insistent that the women of the civil rights movement, wives and also those who were on the front lines, received their due. His wife had passed away by, they were married 58 years by the time we started talking, but he gave her so much credit for pushing him and also supporting him when he went away on the Freedom Rides, when he put his life in danger. Because he was older than some of the other people in the movement, he already had three or four kids when he was going out on the Freedom Rides and risking being beaten. I mean, they all put their lives on the line and all deserve an immense amount of credit and thanks from us. But he had a young family, and his wife, Octavia, constantly said, "You go out, I'll take care of the family." And so in many of our conversations, it came back to talking about how wonderful Octavia was, and what a great relationship they had, and how important the women were to the movement in general.
In those last few years, what thoughts did he share about how he saw this country, how far it had come in some ways, and in other ways, nowhere near enough? What was his outlook toward the end?
First of all, he said he never expected that there would be a Black president in his lifetime. So he was very heartened by the election of President Obama. However, he was devastated by the Shelby v. Holder decision of the Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act that he and so many other people had worked so hard for and that many people had given their lives for. So he felt there was a great deal more that needed to be done. His views of the contemporary movements, Black Lives Matter, and so forth, was he was very supportive of their efforts, of course. He worried at times about the effectiveness of movements that didn't have a particular charismatic leader at the top and one unified strategy that everyone was on the same page with. That can be argued to be one of the strengths of the current movement, the various efforts in various cities and loosely organized together. But in the 60s, when he was deeply involved, everything kind of centered around Dr. King. Of course, when a charismatic figure like that is assassinated, a movement can be devastated. So he was aware that the diversity of Black Lives Matter was a potential strength, but he wanted to see a really cohesive strategy and effort there. He also lamented to a certain extent the absence of the church's involvement as a central player in the movement. As you well know, in the 60s, it grew out of the church. And in fact, one of the things he told me was that one of the few positive things about segregation when he was growing up was that there was a Black church and that therefore the movement was able to grow in the Black church without white leaders imposing their views or their strength to suppress that movement. But he really wished that the church would become more involved in the current civil rights movement.
All right, Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon, live from the Isis Theatre in Asheville, we have a set from Ariella McManus, with her husband Nicholas Cruster playing guitar, James DeBone playing trombone, and John Tipmoney Walker on drums. This is Ariella.
You're just too good to be true. I can't take my eyes off of you. You'd be like heaven to touch, and I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived. I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. No, I can't take my eyes off of you. Pardon the way that I stare. There's nothing else to compare. The sight of you leaves me weak, and there are no words left to speak. And if you feel like I feel, let me know that it's real. You're just too good to be true. I can't take my eyes off of you. To be true, I can't take my eyes off of you. You'd be like a violent touch, and I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived. I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. I can't take my eyes off of you. Take my eyes off of you. You'd be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived. I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. I can't take my eyes off of you. You're too good to be true. I can't take my eyes off of you. Thank you very much.
Oh, oh.
Some girls want diamonds, others want pearls. The ladies love shoes and love their curls. And me, my darling, I love to eat. So let me feast upon your meat. My mama says to find your man, so you must learn to use those pots and pans. But oh, my darling, I must confess, when in the kitchen you must wear the dress. Oh, baby, I won't treat you mean. I'll show you I don't cook or clean. In my boudoir is where I'm supreme. Yes, I know you feel the heat. When dinner's done, it's time to feast. And all I wanna hear you say, bon appetit. You make the money, you are my bee. And I'll give you honey, for I am your queen. I'll be the bird there and sing so sweet. But when I'm hungry, it's you I want to eat. I can be spicy, but I'm also sweet. This hair I got for you is my delicacy. You taste what I'm serving, you be begging me please. You stop your running around, get down on one knee. Oh, oh. Oh baby, I won't treat you mean. I show you I don't cook or clean. In my boudoir is where I'm supreme. Yeah, I know you feel the heat. When dinner's done, it's time to feast and all that. Wanna hear you say, bon appetit. Bon appétit. Bon appétit.
Hey.
Together, I'd love to make it forever. It's been such a long time. But these days you seem much colder. No love, you just roll over. Tell me, have you changed your mind? So terrified, is this one-sided, or have you decided to stay with me and fight for me? Tell me, am I still the only one? You can say if there's another, can she love you better? Or have I done something wrong? With all I know, I still can't gather. Is there someone else you would rather? Is what we had gone? I'm so terrified. Is this one-sided, or have you decided? tell me, am I still the only one? I just want you to stay. Yes, I do. But I need to hear you say, just say it. Cause I'm so terrified. Is this one-sided? Or have you decided to stay with me and fight for me? Tell me, one-sided, oh, have you decided to stay with me and fight for me? Tell me, am I still the only one? Oh, am I still the only one? Azul, la mañana es azul. El sol si le llamo, le llamo vendrá. Se detendrá en mi voz y hasta la eternidad. Y en su camino irá así otro azul. Después no, yo no sé. Después, no, yo no sé si hay después, si el sol volverá a despertar. Porque la canción, la 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 la, no ha de ser verdad. Porque, en carnaval. Mentira, tú, mentira, mentiroso, mentira, tú, en el azul. Después, no, yo no sé si hay después, si el sol volverá a despertar. Porque la canción, la la la, no ha de ser verdad. Porque, en carnaval. Azul, la 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 hasta la eternidad y en su camino así otro así otro azul. Después no, yo no sé si hay después, si el sol volverá a despertar. Porque la canción no ha de ser, no ha de ser verdad. Thank you. mentira, 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 mentira. En el azul después, no, yo no sé si hay después. Si el sol volverá a despertar. Porque la canción, la, 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 la. Porque James DeBone. Si le llamo, vendrá. Se detendrá en mi polla y hasta la eternidad. Y en su camino, y en su camino irá así, otro es su lengua. Yo no sé si hay de tu ser verdad. ¿Por qué?
I'm so glad you enjoyed this. Thank you so much. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Do you want one more song? You guys, so great. This is such a pleasure. It really means a lot because there were literally 12 people here. That's exaggerating. It may have been like six.
It was six.
The last time we were here. And so this is so special that we come back and it's a full room. God bless you. God bless you. God bless you. Oh, may the universe rain down all of your dreams come true. Because that's what you've done for me. You want to end with maybe? Okay.
Maybe.
All right. There's a song that we wrote called Maybe. It's kind of here's a song I wrote. Thank you.
Ari Eller, live from the ISIS Theatre in Asheville on Saturday, the 5th of this month.
Thank you so much.
Video of the performance is on ISIS Theatre Facebook page. This is Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.